Blog Talk Radio.
worldtransformed.com. This program explores a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities which are at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are difficult to predict, sometimes even difficult to imagine. And the World Transformed is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead, one that will be here sooner than you think, and one that you have an important role to play in bringing about. We're not here so much to tell you about the future as we are to encourage you to think about your future, and to consider what may be the biggest transformation of them all, the one that will occur in your life, in your world, the one that begins with recognizing and acting on the vast possibilities that are unfolding before you, and that ends somewhere beyond the reach of the human imagination. So, when does that amazing future begin? Well, today is the day. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you doing?
Well, I'm super fantastic. And how are you, my friend?
I'm doing great, doing great. I want to let you know that our guest has also joined us, so that's great.
I was
going to
say,
well,
am I all alone, are we all alone here in the virtual studio? It looks like we've got our guest with us. Well, I'm going to go ahead and introduce him. Hello, Paul.
Sure.
How are you?
Hello. Okay. Am I on?
Hey. You're on the air. You're
okay.
On the World Transform.
All right. Good time.
Let me remind our listeners about Paul Vasquez. He's a futurist, a humanitarian. He is the vice president of the Singularity Network, and he's a co-founder of MyHelp. He's not yet a sexy immortal billionaire with superpowers, but he says one out of four ain't bad. Steve and I had no idea Paul had that much money. Did you? I had no idea. And if he were a superhero, his motto would be, I like this a lot, for peace, prosperity, and a better tomorrow. Paul, welcome to the World Transformed.
Thank you. It's good to be here. Exciting times we're living in, a lot of great things going on, and I'm excited to be here to talk with you guys about it.
Absolutely. Well, let's start with some basic exciting stuff. So now you're vice president of the Singularity Network. How did that come about?
Great choice.
I'm not questioning the.
It was when Singularity Network first kind of got off the ground. Jean-Sebastian.
So you've been doing it for a while. I'm sorry, I didn't realize you held that role.
But it's okay. I'm not that important. I just help out behind the scenes a lot on a lot of things. So I don't really take a super upfront approach to my vice presidency in Singularity Network.
You just haven't been bragging about it the way Stephen and I would if we were vice president.
Sure. Maybe that's it.
Yeah.
That's it. For the longest time, I just kind of advised Jean-Sebastian and made sure that, I was pretty firm on making sure that the Facebook page group that Singularity Network has was free of too much religious banter. Or things that kind of went outside the scope of the singularity, or if people got too abusive talking with each other. We wanted open forum,
right,
of free discussion, and we didn't want to, we didn't want to take on the battlefield of anything in the religious area. We let people make their own decisions on that aspect, and just keep it to the technology side of things on that webpage. I mean, if people, we're not banding, people talking about any of those things. It's just as a Facebook group in that forum, we've kind of set those rules. And I think it's what's one of the things that's allowed the group to grow so well, because we don't really want there to be exclusion of people because they come from a different society, a different group, or a different, you know, belief. We want all people to be able to understand the importance of accelerating technologies and how they're going to affect our lives.
And, you know, I think that comes through really clear in the way the group is managed. I've seen there's been a fair amount of, I don't know, is the word turmoil fair to use over the last 2 or 3 months around, you know, how certain things are handled and what kinds of things it's cool to talk about. And it seems to me that it's always with good grace and respect for people that that these decisions are made and handed down. And I would just, you know, both to you and to Jean-Sébastien, just congratulate you both on how well that group is managed, frankly.
Oh, thank you. We've turned a lot over nowadays to administrators. And we just try to make sure the administrators understand. Sometimes the turmoil comes up again when we have newer administrators and new people are always joining. So sometimes things aren't caught right away, or people don't understand, who are new to the group, what the forum is for. And
right.
So sometimes that pops up, not because I think anyone comes in there trying to stir up trouble, but just they haven't realized that that's one thing the group's been staying away from.
Right. Right. Yeah, you know, so it's like you end up having to have the same conversation a few times, you know, and you will, as long as new people come in, and hopefully that will will continue to be the case.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
We've had you know, similar decisions about this show, for example, you know, that we have strong opinions about things like politics and religion, but that's just outside of the what we've chosen to focus on. So, you know, and if you focus on this one thing, it seems like the other things would tend to distract from it if it were involved overly. So, yeah,
the thing I always say about this show and about the Speculist, because we have been fairly tight with those rules, the exception being anytime we decide we want to talk about those things, then we talk about it.
Exactly.
But the point is, whether we talk about it or not, there is no lack of opportunity for those things to be discussed.
Right.
It's not like we're shutting down the ability for people to talk about politics on Facebook, or religion on Facebook. It's going on, you know, and it
I'm
will
not
continue
nearly
to go
that
on.
Powerful.
Yeah, exactly. People can talk about those things. But if you want to talk about something else, you have to say, well, this is actually what we're trying to have a conversation about. And sometimes that means you have to draw some lines. You have to have some parameters around
it. Sure. I kind of liken it to a group that wants to talk about football. You know, it's a group that's around a particular football team, and you know, you want to join that group, fine, they're going to let you in if you know you're wanting to talk about football. But then if you come in and say, hey, you know, I'm tired of talking about football, I want to talk about golf, and I think this group needs to be more about golf, they're like, well, that's not really why we started the group, although, you know, I'm sure many of the football enthusiasts aren't opposed to golf, but
right.
That's not why they created that group.
It's not that they have a problem with golf.
Right.
It's just not why they got this started. So listen, I guess we'll sort of work through the agenda in reverse order, and I'm not sure if we'll have time for Last Year in Space, which was promised in the show description. But if we don't do that this week, we'll get to it next week. But the teaser that I think is going to be drawing in listeners by the tens of thousands this evening is that we were going to get a special announcement from you. So go ahead and tell us what's up.
Okay. Some of the biggest announcements around Singularity Network is that we're going to start to have monthly hangouts. That's one of the big things. Recently, we've been talking in the group a lot about some big announcements that we're going to make, and we've been looking at two approaches to help really bring forward the technological singularity. One's a bottom-up approach where we're looking at bringing new people into the idea of the singularity, exposing new people to the idea, and really advocating that more and more people need to understand the importance of this and how it's going to affect all of our lives. That way we can have smoother transitions and a positive singularity, and hopefully not a negative one where we annihilate ourselves or have the machines do it for us. The other one is the top-down approach, where we look at taking people who already have a good understanding of the singularity, have technological or other backgrounds, and start working on creating synergies amongst them to have the projects form and progress made in such a way that, that we have that positive outcome. So we're looking at combining those two approaches. The bottom-up approach, we're going to start with the Singularity Network Hangout. So every month we're going to have a hangout, hopefully hosted in a different city. This month, or in September, on the 21st, we're going to have one in Washington, D.C. And what we'll do is we'll set up the webcam, and we'll have different speakers or different Singularity Network heads be able to be in that chat, so then others can come along, ask questions, and we'll broadcast this as well. So if somebody can't get into the group or isn't able to come to D.C. this month, they can always watch live via YouTube. And then
every month
we hope to host in a different city.
And so the first one you say is in September in D.C., and do you have more cities lined up, or is it happening more organically than that?
What we're looking at is hopefully we'll have a couple people who've begin to say that I think Phil you talked a little bit about possibly looking at
Colorado. One in Denver, absolutely, yes.
And so that's probably how it's gonna go, is we'll get someone who's willing to host one in their city next time, and what we'll do is make sure we have contacts in the previous cities and make sure that that group has a window in the Google chat. So that way they can then host another party the same month at or near the same location, and it can kind of grow organically that way.
That's awesome. Very good. I don't know if my town would be big enough to host one, Shreveport, Louisiana, but maybe Dallas Fort Worth would be doable, and that would be, you know, I would love to attend it there, or maybe Little Rock.
How long of a drive is that for you, Stephen, to get up to Dallas?
It's only about three and a half hours. It's not bad at all.
Well, yeah, let's look at getting something going some month in the future here. We have no shortages of months to come, from what I understand.
Yeah,
I've heard the same. Well, ever since we got past December of last year,
yes.
We seem to have an unlimited supply of coming months. So that's an excellent point. Okay, well, cool. Well, I'll tell you what. We will offline. We'll work on seeing what times will work for us. And Stephen and I are both stepping up as organizers of these in our regions, along with other people who would be appropriate in the Denver area and or the Dallas area to get these things going. But there, you got two more cities
at
some point in the future.
That's great to hear, and it's super fantastic on top of that.
It really is. Yeah.
Now,
so,
to fill you in on the top-down approach.
Yeah, what else you got?
We're looking at creating a website that helps to really have that focus group of individuals and also give the ability to start to create these synergies and work on various ideas and projects. The big details about how that's going to work is going to be set out in our where you do the fundraising, but it's
Kickstarter.
New Kickstarter. Thank you. In our Kickstarter campaign that we're going to be forming. So the real details are going to be fleshed out there. Now the whole reason why this first one's happening around D.C. is because we're putting it there in conjunction with the Radical Life Extension Conference. And there is a subtitle to that. It's Are You Ready to Live 100 Years? Or, I'm sorry, 1,000 Years is the subtitle. Are You Ready to Live 1,000 Years for
cool.
the Radical Life Extension Conference? Have you guys heard anything about that
awesome.
Yet?
You know, I've seen promotional links for it and a little bit of discussion around it. But why don't you fill us in and tell us how Singularity Network is connected?
Well, this event is sponsored right off by Longevity, Maximum Life Extension, and the Center for Transhumanity.
Okay. These
are the main sponsors of the group. I was contacted through MyHelp. As a resource to help market this. MyHelp also has enlisted a marketing company, Inspire, to help with some of the marketing of this. There's other people who are also selling tickets. So there's
and just
lots
to clarify,
of ways.
My help is the nonprofit that you are the head of. Is that right?
That's right. That's right.
Okay.
I'm a co-founder of My Help,
okay,
along with Jennifer Hughes. And we've got some other great people that have been in it since the beginning. But let me go over, there's multiple ways that people can get involved. So first, of course, if you're able to attend, tickets are on sale, and they are rock-bottom pricing here. I mean, I don't think you could get cheaper tickets to such an event, especially because seats are limited. There's only 300 seats at this conference. Tickets are only $10 in advance, $15 at the door. But, you know, with only 300 seats, and I already know there's a good batch that's already been sold. I'm not sure where we're at right now, but there's only 300 seats. So it's something that people need to get on quickly. The location is going to be in D.C. It's at the Friends Meeting Hall. And do you have the link to that you're able to put in the show notes? I put some links throughout some of the material.
Yeah, we can. You know what? I'll get that all up in the.
Okay.
We can put that both in the chat room, and we'll put it in the. We'll put it on the worldtransform.com as well.
Great. And that'll be on the 22nd. From participants will be able to. It'll actually start the speaker. So there's going to be about 12 different speakers who are rapid fire speaking within 2 hours from six. From 5 to 7. And then before, if they're able to make it before, there's going to be a few tables where people are going to be selling their different wares, or My Help is going to have a table. So the tables are also, we're still looking at selling off or renting out the spaces on these tables. So if you're in a business that wants to be able to sell books or supplements or whatever it is, you're going to need to contact me, and we'll get you the links, I guess, in the show notes to get access to those booths. If you're a nonprofit, I would suggest not worrying about the price, but contacting My Help, either me through My Help or someone else at My Help, to see if you can't send us marketing materials and we can just do it for you, because My Help has a table reserved for nonprofits. So I would do it that way if you're a nonprofit on the booth. Now, it doesn't stop there. It doesn't stop. There's even more ways to get involved. I know. It's getting crazy.
All right. What else you got, buddy?
So we have virtual presence services. And how this is going to work is we're going to have cameras set up with broadcasting high-definition video. We're going to make this another hangout. Okay, and we're going to broadcast it on YouTube. So if you can't make it there, you know, for the conference, I understand, because there's only 300 seats, that everyone who wants to go just isn't going to be able to fit in the building.
Right.
So we are going to have it online. Now, before this all goes on, the camera crew is going to be there interviewing both participants and the speakers. So they'll have that online as well. So if they can't be there, they'll still be able to get that. And then afterwards, before things are taken down, we'll continue on with the interviews of participants and the speakers.
So basically, you're opening up the entire event to the world via YouTube. Is that right?
That is correct.
Very cool.
That is correct. On top of that, because it's a Google Chat, We'll be able to get select groups access to being a part of that Google Chat. Now, they'll be muted, so it won't ruin the audio, but you'll still have that chat link available. Now, on top of that...
So you can send in a question, for example?
Well, the questions are part of the marketing of this, because a lot of these things have already been paid for, yet the broadcasting equipment has yet to be paid for. So to help us do that, we're asking companies to help us out. And so a company that wants to help us out and making sure that gets online and is professional quality sends in $50, and they'll get five questions. and then every question after that's $10. Nonprofits can do the same, but they don't have the minimum of the five questions.
So any organization who wants to sponsor this the video feed for this event,
right.
if they're a for-profit, they can do it for $50 and they get five questions. A nonprofit, or would this be true for an individual too? Can just order.
If it's an individual and he wants to do $50 and get five questions, and then every additional question is $10, just fine.
All right. Well, I'll tell you what, Stephen, we've got both Speculus Media and now soon to be announced the World Transformed Institute. So we're gonna caucus offline, and we'll get back in touch with you on how many questions we're gonna be good for.
Oh, great.
We're gonna be good for.
Great.
We're gonna be good for the share.
Because we got questions. We can come up with some questions.
I got some questions about life extension for sure.
You can get a good deal at MyHelp. MyHelp is doing a promotion. Where if you get my votes, which are basically kind of a pseudo currency that you can use to donate to your favorite charities. So if you get 50 my votes, it's a dollar a vote. If you get 50 my votes and you can use them for whatever charity you want, my help will send you a ticket and get you a question. And
awesome.
I think Singularity Network's doing the same thing.
Very good. Okay. So a lot of ways to participate, it sounds like.
Yes, yes. So there is no shortage of their ability to participate, even though there's limited seating.
Right. Well, and so it's good that you're opening it up to the rest of the country via or the rest of the world, really, I should say, via video with so few seats. Well, it sounds like a really exciting event. Now, I've shared the link for the My Help page. I'm looking for the actual link for the event itself. I haven't found that yet. If you want to share that with me in chat, Paul, I'll go ahead and put that up on.
I will in the future. Right now, I'm actually in kind of a dead zone. I'm down at the lake. I don't have internet. I do have a rotary phone, but it wouldn't let me push one to get the request. So I had to go grab the digital here. So I could actually press one, because the rotary, there was no pressing.
I love the image, Stephen, of someone
that
calling
is,
into the World Transformed on a rotary phone. That's
and getting frustrated when they can't press one.
That makes my day, I have to say. That's pretty cool.
I love that. So
folks listening in, look at theworldtransformed.com. We'll have all the details on the event. And if you're listening live right now in the chat room, I've got the link to the My Help page over on Facebook, where you can get more information on what are they called? My votes that you can earn.
My
and,
votes.
Yeah.
If you're wanting to donate, it doesn't have to be to Singularity Network. It doesn't have to be to My Help. To just about any charity you want, you can use those My Votes for.
Very cool. All right.
We track
Paul, that
you.
Is some super fantastic, very exciting stuff that you've got going on there with the Singularity Network, and I'm really pleased to hear that there are going to be both live events and these hangouts that are going to give people an opportunity to interact other than, because currently most of the interaction in the Singularity Network is the discussions on Facebook, as far as I know.
Right.
And I actually have to prevent myself from doing that, because when Singularity Network first started, I found that I was going to like lose my entire life to being in Singularity Network discussions. I had no self-control where that was concerned, and now I just allow myself to mostly lurk. Right. I hang in the corners and follow discussions that are going. Once in a while, I'm like, no, I have to say something, and I chime in. But the idea of there being a live event or kind of a contained, okay, we're all going to get together for an hour once a month or a couple hours or however long the hangouts last, I think that's great. And also it's going to be a real opportunity for people to put faces with names, for people to meet in person. Just a terrific way, I think, for the group to grow along the lines that I know you and Jean-Sébastien have been talking about.
Yeah, we've had a lot of great help along the way. I can't say it's just been us two. We have had a lot of great help along the way, and we're grateful for everyone who's been pitching in, because You know, I care about peace, prosperity, and a better tomorrow, and I think the singularity can do that if we work towards it.
If we do it right, yes, that's right. And if we don't, boy, it can take us in a completely different direction.
Yeah, it could happen.
Yeah, I saw Elysium today, by the way, gentlemen, and that was, you know, we don't want to go down that road. I promise you, we want a happier future. We have to do the singularity right. I think that's an important point.
Well, actually, Elysium has got the right model, right? It's just that everybody needs to be in the shape that the people in Elysium are in, right? That's the only problem with that.
Exactly.
Right. I haven't seen the movie, but, you know, I do work out quite a bit, so I don't know. I have no idea if that's what you're referring to.
No, I just meant that they're not so much their physical condition, it's just their economic condition. The people who live in Elysium, they're...
1 out of 4.
Yeah. they're enjoying unbelievable post-scarcity prosperity and tech. Basically, Stephen, they're living pretty close to the Cory Doctorow Bitchin' Society model, right? Post-scarcity,
exactly.
Post-employment, post-mortality, all those
kinds of things. While the entire world just goes to hell, everybody on Elysium is just doing fine, and part of that picture is you know, incredible medical technology available to those on Elysium. There's, you know, they don't ever age, or they age, but you know, they can be regenerated every day. You know, they just get in their little pod machine and they, you know, whatever problems they have are solved. And while that technology is completely out of reach for people on the Earth, and so that's the setup for the movie. And you know, yeah, I highly recommend. It's a great movie. Don't want to give away too much, but we got to do the singularity a little better than that.
Yeah, I think so. I think it will happen differently than that too. You know, I'm inclined to believe. Segueing here into our main topic of the evening, that
yep.
Things are likely to go well in the future. And I think that that is an idea that is not it's not a popular idea, and it's an idea that people tend to reject. And that's where we came up with the idea of calling our quiz last week The Shocking Truth. We took, Paul, I don't know if you had a chance to tune in, but basically we took some not terribly hard to figure out statements about trends that are occurring right now, or things that have happened over the last 100 years or so, or things that are likely to happen over the next 100 years, and stated them as true or false statements, and just by kind of queuing them up a little bit, made things that are false sound true, and mostly made things that are true. Made things that are false sound like they were true. They sounded plausible.
I'll have to listen to the show.
Yeah, well, Stephen did really well. He got 10 out of 10 on the quiz.
Oh,
and now that I've given away the gimmick, Paul, I would expect you to get 10 out of 10 too, although I think you probably would have nailed it anyhow, being an acceleration-aware guy like yourself. However, there's been some blowback, or feedback anyway, on this. some of the points that we came up with, Stephen, have been challenged. And
yep.
I investigated one of the points that we discussed right at the very end of the show. So I thought it'd be a good idea to just spend a few minutes on the things that were in contention. Now, one of the questions on the show last week had to do with sexual assault. In fact, I'll go ahead and I'll bring that up so that we can revisit the exact question. And it was. Number 5, as the overall rate of U.S. violent crime continues to grow, women stand a greater risk than ever of being sexually assaulted. Paul, true or false?
Can you repeat it one more time?
Sure. As the overall rate of U.S. violent crime continues to grow, women stand a greater risk than ever of being sexually assaulted.
I would say false.
False is our answer to that question. Absolutely, that is the answer.
Only because
that,
time you don't give a time frame.
No. Okay. Yeah. No, it's not that.
Right.
It's not
so
that
I mean,
tricky.
If you stretch that statement on forever, as violent crimes go down, well, sexual assault is would be considered a violent crime. So at some point, you know, that's going to reach a point where, you know, there's none to speak of.
Exactly right. I mean, you're on the right track. And in fact, we cited research that shows that not only is violent crime going down, but in particular, instances of sexual assault have decreased significantly since the 1970s. The pushback that I got on this, I thought this was very interesting, is that was around two things. I was told that this news might not be nearly as good as we thought it was because probably what's happening is not nearly as many are being reported, and that because of the widespread use of the practice of plea bargaining today, that there are many fewer convictions because there's fewer criminal convictions of a lot of crimes simply because people, you know, they plea bargain down to they plead down to a lesser crime. So to make sure they get the conviction, the rape will be toned down to assault and battery or something like that. And I said, okay, well, that's interesting. So what's actually happening, right? What are the numbers actually telling us? And I found this report. It's the Crime Victimization Survey, which is, I just want to say to everyone, not exactly light weekend reading. Okay, when you read through this thing, this is pretty heavy stuff. But they talk about female victims of sexual violence from 1994 to 2010, and here's what they say. This survey actually looks at not just convictions, but reports, and in fact, not just reports, but the number of incidents that occur that go unreported. And when you take all of that into consideration, guess what? You see the exact same drop that was shown in the official criminal statistics. So, in fact, both of those arguments don't hold up, at least from 1994 to 2010. Sexual assault definitely has been going down. So, Stephen, we were correct in saying that one was false.
And I'm just going to throw out a guess here that I would think that there would be more, be higher percentages of rapes that are reported than in the past. In the past, there was more of a tendency, I would think, to blame the victim, and therefore a victim might remain quiet. Whereas now, times change. I think more victims are coming forward than before. That's just a guess. Did you see something in the study that would back me up on that guess?
Not in that particular study. Now, I did see that issue batted around. Okay, I actually saw some writing that suggests that fewer are reported, and some that suggested that more are reported. And I couldn't get a beat on anyone who is, absolutely talking with any authority on the subject. So,
I'll just retire my guess. But it's good news. I mean, there's no way to spin this to make bad news out of that. Rapes are going down.
But I would share your assumption there. It seems to me that if anything, people are more likely to report it today than because it's less stigmatized. They're less likely to blame the victim. All those reasons. We're more familiar with the subject. I mean, there was a time when it was just like not even a thing that you wanted to say, right? I mean, you still don't want to say it, and obviously you don't want it to happen. But I think the subject is something that people can deal with more easily now, and it would seem to me that it would be more likely that people report it. But I couldn't get a straight answer on that.
I think we might be looking at this from a societal viewpoint, whereas listeners and other people who have probably given you that little pushback may be coming at it at more of a personal level, whether they themselves or they know somebody else who's been a survivor of these violent and horrific acts. For them, it's very real. The pain is still there, and there's nothing that's really going to be able to take that away from their lives. And so I think, while societally, things are getting better for individuals who are affected by it, I don't know if their ability to overcome that or our ability to help them overcome that has increased at all.
Yeah, it probably doesn't help that much, does it? I mean, knowing that that the statistically it's less likely. Might be some comfort in there, but you're right. Anyone who's gone through that horrible, traumatic experience is going to respond to that subject in a understandably emotional way. I think you make a good point there, Paul. Now, I went looking for older info to see if I could backdate it to the 70s, which is what the original study did, and I found something this is interesting. From about 13 years ago, Stephen. So that I think this partly answers your question, but it's a little out of date. But it was actually on feminist.com. Okay, so the report was, or the headline was, new report shows dramatic increase in willingness to report rapes to police. And it says rape victims are significantly more likely to report their attack to the police than they were just a few years ago, according to the 2002 National Crime Victimization Survey. So again, for the period, up to 2010, I don't know, but for the period leading up to 2000, they were seeing exactly that kind of thing. Second paragraph, I think, is very telling. The percentage of all rapes and sexual assaults that were reported to police rose to 53.7% last year, up from less than 30% in 1999. While this increase should be interpreted cautiously, given the small sample size, it does continue a trend that began in 2000. So at that point, and I wish I could find more up-to-date data, it looks like things were heading in that direction. If anyone has more up-to-date info, that would be great. But it goes on to say that the total number of sexual assaults in the U.S. continued its record decline last year. This would have been 1999. So, again, we're going back a few years. But once again, as best I can piece together data to back this up, the original statement was false. And thank God the rate actually has gone down. And it's not just hidden in the numbers someplace. So I feel pretty good about getting that one correct. Now the next one is a little bit tricky, okay? Because Paul, we're going to put you on the spot once again. Okay, are
okay.
You ready?
Cool.
Yeah, it's great having you on for exactly this reason. all right, here we go. Now this was question number one. Due to out of control residential and commercial real estate development, total U.S. forest acreage is the smallest it has been in a century. True or false?
In a century?
Yes.
I'd say false.
That is correct. The truth is that there are a lot more trees than there were 100 years ago, and that U.S. forests grew about 380% between 1920 and 1997. But we got pushback.
I think we're a lot more conscious about what we're actually doing, whereas previously we may not have been as conscientious about deforestation.
I think that's a huge piece of it. Stephen and I talked about this last week. A big part of it is that farming became much more efficient. We don't have the small family farms scattered out all over the place. We have big farms and fewer of them. Yields of crops are much greater, so all this land isn't being used, and it's going back to becoming forest. But the piece we all missed that someone pointed out to me is that a good deal of this is due to tree farms, okay, which technically are forests, but they don't have nearly the biodiversity of real forests. And I looked into this. According to the U.S. Forest Service, this is true. Tree farms, they make up a large share of U.S. forest land, especially in the south. I guess there's just, down your way, Stephen, there's just acres and acres of pine tree growing in farms. I don't know if
that's
right. A big thing.
Yeah, there's a lot of that
yeah.
here. Yeah.
Yeah. They grow fast in the warmer climate and the wetter climate, and it's a good place to make it happen. But the point about biodiversity is well taken where tree farms are concerned. And the U.S. Forest Service and some other groups have put together guidelines to help make these kind of artificial forests more biodiverse. And the big question is how best to get this public good of biodiversity into these forests, which are on private property. So this is the issue that's being dealt with right now, and it's really interesting reading. The U.S. Forest Service talks about all the options we have for how we can make this happen, and they talk about how different variations of this are being tried. That it can be done through regulation, right? You can say, well, if you're going to have a tree farm, you've got to grow it this way, or introduce these species or something like that. It can be done through financial incentives like tax breaks to the tree farmers. It can be done through incentive payments that are handled through the private sector. Nonprofits who are interested in conservation will actually put together a fund and say, hey, tree farmer, we'll pay you this much of what you're going to be losing out of the yield of your crop if you will, you know, add some more variety to your forest that you're creating. And another option is payments directly from the Forest Service, directly from the government. So these are all possible options for this, and some of these get tied into discussions of carbon tax and carbon units and some of those kinds of things. But this one seems to stand a little bit apart just because it's its own unique thing, and because there are a number of solutions that are already being implemented. And it looks like it's an interesting opportunity to kind of try several things, and we'll see what sort of rises to the surface as the thing that's most effective at adding some biodiversity there. There's probably not going to be a quick resolution to that, but I think that one of the things that's very encouraging about this is that there's competing models. So we'll see if we don't get some additional biodiversity into those tree farm forests before too long. Meanwhile, I found a couple of other interesting tidbits that speak to this. I found a headline that really kind of surprised me. Listen to this, guys. Eastern U.S. forests growing faster than they have in two centuries due to what? Anyone care to fill in the blanks?
Global warming.
Well, yes, that's not the politically correct term. The politically correct term is climate change, but exactly.
Climate change.
What I just said about the tree farms, right? The eastern U.S. forest is benefiting from warmer weather and more CO2 in the atmosphere. And really, really interesting article. Ecologists working at the – I'll just read a snippet here – working at the Smithsonian Environment Research Center studying the rate of growth over hardwood forests in Maryland over the past 20 years have determined that trees there are growing faster than they have in the past 225 years, growing 2 to 4 times faster than baseline growth. And check this out. The research shows that on average, the forests they studied are putting on an additional 2 tons of biomass per acre annually. Now, here's what's interesting, guys. These forests are the biodiverse kind, right? This is exactly the kind of forest that we want more of. And they're growing like gangbusters. So this is that odd little, oh yeah, upside of climate change that we're not supposed to talk about or think about. But that seems to be a pretty good result of climate change if you're looking at both sides of that coin. Particularly because another Forest Service report I looked at that was more of a technical study talked about how much carbon is being sequestered in this additional biomass that is being introduced. So not only are the forests growing faster, but they're helping to take CO2 out of the atmosphere in the process. So I see that as fairly good news. It's especially good news in that it sort of potentially helps in some ways to mitigate the climate change situation overall. And then I saw one other thing that I'm going to mention
was,
about.
Was this study before or after the fires out in California?
It would have been before, I think. And this is the East Coast, not West. So,
okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Well, here in Colorado, we've lost quite a bit of forest to fires the last couple of summers too. And in addition to that, we've had this beetle blight, which they say is worse because of climate change. If we could just get a cold enough winter, it would kill all these beetles, but we haven't had one yet, and they're eating our trees. Anyway, one final note on the forest issue, which I had not seen anything quite like this before, because when you get into the question of biodiversity generally, there's a good deal of back and forth. It's kind of like looking at the sexual assault issue. There's a lot of people saying one thing. There's a lot of people saying something else. One of the things that most agree on is that actually climate change is generally beneficial towards biodiversity at this point, that the kinds of temperature increases we're seeing are increasing biodiversity. In the long run, if the temperature goes too high, species start to go extinct, and you start to, you know, the bottom of that starts to fall out. But where we are right now, that's not what we're seeing happening. But that's not the big driver of biodiversity, and I had no idea what the big driver of biodiversity is on a local scale. it's actually human beings. And this is a quote from a piece. It was actually at Reason.com. It says, the popular view is that diversity is decreasing at local scales. This was a biologist from Brown University speaking at a conference in, actually, 2007, that North America presently has more terrestrial bird and the truth is that North America presently has more terrestrial bird and mammal species than when the first Europeans arrived 5 centuries ago. And the reason, of course, is because commerce, the transportation of human beings between the continents, has introduced forms of life. Now, the big worry always is that a new species gets introduced, it eliminates the existing species. And according to this piece, it says, while some introduced species do outcompete natives and contribute to their extinction, the phenomenon is relatively rare. On the whole, the actual number of species in any given area has tended to increase. And an interesting example here, New Zealand's 2,000 native plant species have been joined by 2,000 from elsewhere, doubling the plant biodiversity of all of New Zealand. Meanwhile, only 3 species of native plants have gone extinct. In California, here we go, Paul, California, an additional 1,000 new species of vascular plants have joined the 6,000 native species in the Golden State, while just 40 species have gone extinct. And there are other interesting examples. When the Suez Canal opened up, a whole bunch of new fish species got introduced into the Mediterranean and into the Red Sea, resulting in 2 or 3 extinctions, but massive increased biodiversity. So my bottom line on this one, I guess I have to say, is that biodiversity is a complex issue. It's something that we want, but we seem to want it more when it occurs naturally than when human beings make it happen. Then it becomes a little bit more suspicious, at least in the eyes of some. But the overall original statement, Stephen, that we made was true. There's more forest than there was. And not only is there more forest in North America than there was, there's more biodiversity in North America than there was. Unfortunately, there's just acres and acres and acres of not terribly biodiverse forest, and that's kind of the footnote to that one. So as we revise our shocking truth quiz going forward, I guess we'll have to either restate our questions a little more carefully or maybe come up with better examples.
Yeah, it's... I would just, as far as a policy argument, I would say, allow those landowners that have that would normally plant a bunch of pine trees, tell them, don't plant pine trees, just leave your ground fallow and let whatever grow, whatever will grow, and we'll give you a big tax break. I think that's use the carrot approach rather than the stick approach, like the federal wetlands program has been, where we basically say you can't do anything because you've got a little natural moisture on your land, therefore you're develop it. That's been a popular program, as you might imagine, with land. But say let's use a carrot approach next time.
Yeah, but the great thing about a forest is that you can have it be less pristine of a just pure grove of pine trees by letting some other stuff in and still take timber from it, right? I mean, it's possible for them to introduce biodiversity and for it to continue to be their farmland, which it would be hard to do with a wetlands, right? you'd be hard pressed to pull that off there. So, but the same incentives could apply. Right. If you introduce these species, if you plant or allow some of this kind of stuff to occur on your land, you get a tax break or whatever the incentive would be. But I think we will see that. I think we'll see it heading in that direction.
Climate change may also help to bring about more wetlands, as water is no longer frozen and trickles down into the land. You may have more wetlands, which is some of the biggest bastions of biodiversity. On human beings affecting the biosphere. I believe I heard a report recently on actually birds starting to boom in certain areas because they actually started having shorter wingspans. And the shorter wingspans allowed them to weave in and out in traffic more quickly. So there was some Darwinian effect that we caused on this bird population And after all those with the larger wings were killed off by the cars, those with the shorter wings began to have a boom in population, because that's what the new ecology that people created allotted for, was a better lifespan or population growth for those birds with shorter wings.
Just basically, they've been selected in favor of. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. There you go. That's interesting, because in any other time, I bet wingspans were probably getting bigger, right? You know what I mean? That probably was an evolutionary advantage to have them bigger in the past, and now it's worked the other way. Fascinating. Ah, nature. It's endlessly fascinating, but. Not quite as mysterious as our final topic, which is the one that Ken introduced in the chat room right at the end of last week's show. I think it was Ken who said that our national debt is going down. Now, I did my best to research this one, okay? Let me tell you, there is an answer. Whatever you want to hear about the national debt, there is someone to tell you that, okay? So we could add this one to the quiz and have it be true or false, and back it up really well. Okay, that's all I can that's all I can tell you about that. Definitely, there has been a dip in the national debt this year. It happened last month, and it primarily occurred because of a big repayment from Fannie Mae. They took some
like $60,000 in bonds or something like that.
Like
I just read it in the
billion.
Paper, I think, today.
Yeah, yeah. And the best summary that I've got of what's happening, I found over on the freemoneyminute.com, where he seemed to be just trying to talk about what's happening and not make a big partisan statement one way or another. And here's what he says. He says, the national debt is going down. For the first time in a long time, the national debt of the United States has gone down. So, yes, good news. It did go down. It is not – so if you – actually, Stephen, we could put this one on the quiz and say, is it a steady rise? False. It's not, because it actually went down last month. According to treasurydirect.gov, the agency that reports the exact state of our debt on a day-to-day basis, the debt in the U.S. as of April 9, 2013 was $16.8 trillion. As of July 20, 2013, it stood at about $16.738 trillion. Okay, so, you know, not huge movement, but definitely movement down, which is good. A decrease of about $70 billion. Now, to guys like us, $70 billion sounds like quite a bit of money. It goes on to say, unfortunately, $70 billion is only 4% of the total debt that the United States owes. It would take over 200 payments of $70 billion to pay off our debt. And the prediction from the Free Money Minute .com is that we will be back in back headed in the other direction probably within the next couple of months, certainly by the end of the year. His prediction is certainly by the end of the year. Others have been talking about the amount of national debt relative to gross national product, and that figure also seems to be improving. So depending on how you want to look at it, the economy is definitely getting a little bit healthier in terms of that relationship. In terms of the debt actually going down, it did go down, but there was a big thing that happened that caused that to happen, and unfortunately, I don't think we can count on we can count on that one to continue to go down. I no one would be happier than I would if it does, but looks like that one's pretty iffy.
It's good
news.
Well, it is. Oh, yeah, $70 billion is good news. I agree. It's just not as good as we'd like it to be. I guess that's the...
Strategically, money devalues over time anyways. So you have the devaluation of what, you know, that however $60 trillion or whatever you said it was. What that actually means as far as purchasing power will decrease over time because of natural trends of inflation. So you have the 3% or whatever, you know, it's being held to at the moment. But then, you know, if you're able to boost your GDP over that, your ability to produce is gonna far exceed what debt you do have, so that that trillions of dollars won't seem as much, especially once we start mining the asteroids, right?
Exactly. Yeah, no, that's a good point. If you can keep the debt amount the same and keep the economy growing, it effectively goes down.
Just make sure it's growing faster, the economy is growing faster than the debt.
Yeah, as long as that's happening, then it is effectively going down. You're right, even if it's going up. If the one is happening faster than the other, you face this situation where you go, yeah, well, $16 trillion doesn't buy you what it used to, right? And
it's like
days when that was a significant amount of money, I guess, right?
Yeah. Well, it's like the guy that earns minimum wage having $50,000 in credit card debt. That's a crisis. A guy that's a multimillionaire. $50,000 in credit card debt is not a problem at all. One solution to this problem would be to just continue to be prosperous as a nation and as a world, and that's all the nations more
this,
prosperous.
This is why
no
we,
doubt.
We've really gotten into such a high debt is because that's kind of known in a lot of economic spheres. And a lot of political spheres, it's this idea that if they just keep borrowing and then try to put that money into innovation and education, it'll grow. But what happens is when they borrow that extra money to try to bolster our economy, sometimes that money doesn't actually end up going into bolstering our economy. It goes into other things which don't, go towards innovation and education. So Neil deGrasse Tyson would be happier if some of that money went into the space program, because we would see then eventually our economy growing faster because of the innovation. But the reality, while they have good intentions, the reality of it is that they're not always putting that extra money back into growth areas.
Right. I mean, exactly. That's,
And I would say that's absolutely true, but then I would counter it and say that even when their best intentions are not met, and even when you could even call, even if there's corruption where, they're just lying, somehow that still ends up back into the economy in one way or another. Maybe not in ways that we like necessarily, but it just seems like we have a healthy enough system in a lot of ways that we're able to overcome a lot of the worst aspects of that. At least we have so far, and we just continue to keep. We don't abuse the system overly.
I think that might be more of what's happening in North America, and some South American countries and things like that, where governments kind of just the president will just steal everybody's money and then go off. It really hasn't helped some of these other countries when there's that type of corruption going on. It really doesn't help their economic point.
Yep.
The rule of law has helped us maintain a bit more in our country than maybe some of the others. Those in charge just stealing money, large quantities, and running away.
Well, I'll
exactly.
tell you, we're just about out of time here, but I think the three of us can agree that with $16 trillion in debt, wouldn't it make sense to just take another trillion and get this mining the asteroids thing going? I think... I think that's an excellent. I think we had that quote from Peter Diamandis 2 weeks ago. Didn't he say that some single asteroids are worth a couple of trillion, right? So all we need to do is find like eight of those and problem solved. Anyway, that's my solution to the whole problem. And actually, I got it from
you. Sounds like a good one.
You suggested it. But almost out of time. I was. Looking so carefully at my notes, I didn't get the chance to respond to Jeb's comments about the incredible heat wave they had in Tokyo a short while ago, 2 weeks ago. He says 124 degrees Fahrenheit when you count the humidity
and the
death toll from that. Terrible state of affairs there. And not the sort of thing we're ever downplaying when we talk about the fact that that good things are happening. When we talk about the shocking truth, I think the shocking truth is that the world is getting better in spite of the fact that that we face all these challenges. Paul, I want to thank you very much for being with us this evening.
Thank you for having me.
And Stephen, what's our music?
Our music tonight is Coming Off Pretty by the House of Jed.
All right, Coming Off Pretty by the House of Jed. Thanks for putting that together. Thanks, everyone, for being with us. We'll be back again with a brand new show next Wednesday evening. And until next time, live to see it.